Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Cryptocurrency is a big topic, especially as Canada emerges as a leading player in the sector. But with a market that fluctuates wildly, where does Canada fit? We'll talk to CoinSquare's CEO, Cole Diamond. Then, investing is all about making decisions, which stock to buy, which stock to sell, and when. It can be an emotionally charged endeavor, increasing the chances that bias will influence your decisions. We'll talk about behavioral biases as it relates to investing with Richardson GMP's Chief Investment Officer, Craig Bassinger. And commuting to work can eat up a huge amount of time and money. Whether you travel by car, transit, or any other mode of transportation, everyone is looking for easy ways to save. We'll find out how to cut the cost of commuting from personal finance expert Jessica Moorhouse. Plus, entrepreneurs can be busy running their own businesses, too busy to do their own investing. According to author Jeff Weiner, what entrepreneurs need is a quick business strategy for profit allocation. He's here to take us through the strategy with his new book, The Kick-Ass Entrepreneur's Guide to Investing. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Cryptocurrency, of course, isn't new, but it continues to make headlines for its big gains and sometimes losses. As with any hot investment, many Canadians are jumping on the bandwagon, hoping to make it big. But how much do they actually know about their country's digital currency market? Joining us now from Toronto is CoinSquare CEO Cole Diamond. Hello there.
Hey, how are you, Bruce?
What role does Canada currently play in the cryptocurrency market? Are we punching above our weight?
I think we're punching way above our weight. I think it's important for people to remember that Ethereum was born here. Unfortunately, it didn't stay due to some regulatory concern, but there's a lot of other great projects like Aon and Polymath and other blockchain businesses with cryptocurrency behind them or otherwise, and a lot of strong trading platforms. We'd like to think CoinSquare is one of them. And other aspects of the ecosystem where, we're really developing some real value and hopefully we'll play a meaningful role in reshaping the technological world.
Why is that? Why was Canada in early here?
Well, I think Canada was in early because a lot of this started in, meetup groups and wherever you had small pockets of early innovators, especially impressive ones like Vitalik Buterin or Anthony DiOrio and others like it, those groups got bigger and bigger, faster and faster in Toronto than they did in other places, just because you had some early adopters that were leading the charge. And not to mention, I think we all know that Toronto's become a major technology hub, especially over the last 5 to 10 years. And so why not lead the charge on the blockchain side?
Pretend I'm an 8-year-old and now define the various pieces of the air quotes ecosystem. So I have some sense for all the different types of players that are in this space.
In the blockchain and cryptocurrency space in general?
Yeah.
Well, you have exchanges or trading platforms that enable people to buy the currencies or the utility tokens, or in some cases, the security tokens. You have the blockchain businesses that are developing infrastructure for this new integrated world. You've got the regulators, who are very important players in this process to make sure that the rules are being followed and investors and businesses and are being protected. You've got banks that are enabling, or so 2018 is gone, not enabling the flow of money into the space. And you've really, the driving force behind all this is people, innovators, that are coming out with great new ideas in terms of how we can build that next layer on top of the internet that further connects us all. That might have been a little more high level than an 8-year-old would be looking for, but it is a complicated space.
I know some smart 8-year-olds. I think you did well there. How do these currencies get? I'm using air quotes again. Get mined? What should people know about that process? We know that there's lots of talk about the power required from computers. How does that work? Because I think one of the conceptual hurdles people have is a challenge understanding what the currency actually is, knowing that every currency is in digital form now anyway, but at least there's a government backstop and a central bank of some sort.
Okay, so that was a really heavy question, so I'm going to try and break it down a little bit for the people that listen to your show.
Okay.
Right down to how to the initial aspect of your question, which is how are the currencies actually mined? Okay. So the first thing that I should note is for a long time, really leading up until maybe the beginning of this year, it was quite profitable for pretty much anyone to mine, particularly Bitcoin, initially through their computers because it didn't require a lot of computing power, and then through these specialized machines that enabled them to mine more efficiently. But because there's been so much activity coming into the space, I would strongly suggest that people not try and mine on their own because there's just been so much investment that comes in behind it. But effectively, the way mining works is there are these now effectively supercomputers that people buy, and they're buying them in mass, and you're seeing actually a lot of public companies that are buying thousands and thousands of these machines and spending hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars a month to power them. And the simplicity of actually mining at the base level, based on the way most people understand it, is you buy these supercomputers and you plug them into an enormous amount of power, and then they generate coins. But the way they actually generate coins goes a little bit deeper than that, because like anything else in the world, strength comes in power and numbers. So all these miners, they're generating what's called hash rates for these supercomputers. And that hash rate is being sent up to these mining pools where that strength and power and numbers really happens. And collectively, all this hash rate is working to solve the complex transactions that power the blockchain. And once those transactions are solved for, the coins are earned and distributed to the miners.
What are the warnings that you would provide for people who are considering getting into the actual trading of cryptocurrencies? Many people have done well, some have not done so well. What worries me about it is when I talk about people who don't have money to lose, getting into a bigger way than, you know, more than they'd spend at the, you know, the local casino on the weekend.
Yeah, so I don't give investment advice specific to the space because I do run a trading platform and I want to make sure that I don't have conflicts of interest. So I like to be a little bit more general in my response to your question by saying cryptocurrency investing really should, especially at this immature stage of the market, should really only be for those that make the odd bet here and there with a few thousand dollars or tens of thousands of dollars to bet on the sort of investments where they can make 10 times or more on their money, or they can afford to lose it all. Because if you can't afford to lose it all, and although I very much believe in the space maturing in general, I can't tell you what coin is going to win. I can't tell you, is it going to be Bitcoin? Is it going to be Ethereum? Is it going to be another coin we've never heard of? So you've got to be a fairly sophisticated investor to place a big bet. If you want to throw a few $100 at it, go for it. But the other thing that people really need to be careful with is the time horizon that they're betting on. You don't want to come into the market and expect, you know, a 2-week return or a 2-month return or a 6-month return. When you're dealing with an emerging or a new innovative market, you've got to give it quite some time for it to get to a point of maturity. So people are freaking out right now because Bitcoin is only at $6,000. But if you look back 12 months ago, okay, it's 50% higher than it was 12 months ago.
Right.
Okay. Unfortunately, it's 70% down from the high. But we don't know where it's going to be 12 months from now. So I wouldn't panic if you've put money into it, and I wouldn't be concerned about when to pick your timing. Just pick your date, put your money in, and get off to the races.
What should people know about the taxation?
People should know that it's taxed, particularly in Canada, effectively as a capital gain, and you should pay attention to, therefore, when you buy it and when you sell it. So if you put your money, let's say, onto CoinSquare and you buy and sell 30 times, every gain and loss needs to be calculated. And then effectively, if it's a gain, it's a capital gain. And if it's a loss, it's a capital loss, which can be written off against your taxes. So if you're in the highest tax bracket, any gains that you've had will cost you effectively 26.5%.
Right. Do you track those gains and losses, or is that something people need to get the napkin out for?
So we do the best that we can on the platform for users to track their gains and losses. But what you have to keep in mind is that a lot of people, they'll come onto our platform with Canadian dollars, they'll buy their Bitcoin, they'll send it somewhere else, and then they'll bring it back. And we don't know what's happened in between. So we can really only go so far with the tracking. And unfortunately, the market's not sophisticated enough. But people need to know and understand, like anything else, be honest with the CRA. If you made 20 grand, tell them you made 20 grand.
Interesting. Well, Cole, we're going to leave it there, but I appreciate your time. I have a hunch that we're going to talk about this stuff again.
I look forward to it. Thanks, Bruce.
Cole Diamond is the CEO of Coinsquare.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Everybody has biases. People make judgments every day about one another, about opportunities, politics, and the stock market. This is because when we analyze something, we put our observations through a variety of filters created by our experiences that can sometimes make our decisions biased. It's these same behavioral patterns that can also influence investing. Here to tell us more is Craig Bassinger. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Richardson GMP. Hello there.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Is this the soft, fuzzy, touchy, warm, gushy part of investing when really all you want to do is crunch numbers day and night?
Well, let's just start by there's more than enough people already crunching numbers.
Yeah.
You know, trying to get an edge and running a discounted cash flow model on any company, if there's 50 people doing it, I just don't see where that edge is going to be. However, what I think is changing, and behavioral finance is leading into this, is that we all have biases, and they help us get through everyday life. They're not actually bad things. They help us process an immense amount of information, and they usually help us get to the right decision. However, when it comes to investing, most often those shortcuts actually lead you to making mistakes and investment mistakes.
Now, let's talk a bit more about the benefits of bias, because mostly it's used in a pejorative way. It's a racial bias. It's a discrimination of some sort. But our brain works this way for a reason. Why?
Yeah, well, there is way too much stimulus out there. We need shortcuts to be able to process information. If even driving down the road, you know, you're not paying attention to every car around you, but somehow there's a shortcut in your mind that if the car on the right-hand lane starts to veer into your lane, you automatically react. You weren't ever actually even paying attention to it. This is a shortcut, and these kind of shortcuts, again, help us in everyday life, but they also, and you're right, the word bias has a terrible negative
yep.
connotation, but the shortcuts in everyday life actually help us most often get to the right answer. The problem is investing is more of a contrarian business, and usually it's doing the opposite of what feels right is usually, when it comes to investing, the right thing. And because of that, it leads to more mistakes caused by the bias.
So let's talk about a couple of examples. Confirmation bias. How would you define it, and how is it relevant to investing?
Well, confirmation bias, actually, even outside of investing, is probably the most prevalent bias that exists right now. And that's thanks to great people at Facebook and Google.
You know, say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if you Google something and search something and actually imply what your interests are, you start getting, you've probably noticed, you start getting pop-up ads, and
yep.
your filters are then run through their algos to give you more things that you're going to that you believe in or
right.
agree with.
And politically, within your Facebook group, it's quite common to be friends with people who share your view of the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they make no qualms about it. They're doing it because they're trying to get ad clicks.
Yeah.
And they know if they show you more information that you already believe with, you will have a higher tendency to click on that ad and give them a nickel or a dime or whatever the going rate is. The problem with investing is, and we run into it, our whole team, we're very positive on the U.S. dollar. We have been for probably the last 2.5 years. Yet our whole team is in that camp. And that can cause you to sort of miss things. You start to only read reports that actually agree with you. You tend to look at reports that disagree with your views and sort of discount them, going, oh, that's wrong because of this or the other factor. When in reality, investing, unfortunately, it's a very uncertain business. It's a game of probabilities. Actually going out and telling people, like, we believe we're 70% right and 30% chance we're wrong. That's never good marketing.
So how do you counteract that? Do you say to one of the partners, you need to come to the next meeting with the bear case on the U.S. dollar?
Yeah. So
hold nothing back.
What we do in our team is we'll have a bull bear argument where people are assigned which side they're going to be on. And they have to come in full guns a-blazing based on how they've been allocated. But the other aspect, you know, this is where confirmation bias is actually pretty easily mitigated to a degree, is that once you actually start considering the other aspects, you will actually start to read the other views and start to look at other sides. And it actually encourages more critical thinking. A, an activity that is woefully missing in our society today.
Framing is another bias. Define that, and how does that manifest itself in investing?
Well, framing, and I'll group that in with anchoring, is largely caused by people's adherence to what they paid for something. And, you know, there's no question what you paid for it matters because you either made money or you lost money. But people take it very personally. And if they paid $100 for something and it's now $80, they sit there and they go, no, I won't sell this until it's back to $100,
right,
even though I don't like it anymore. And they're anchored to that original price. And that's obviously dangerous because if the thesis has changed and the outlook has changed, everything's changed. And even the reason you bought it at $100 has changed. And you're sitting there suffering from what people call get evenitis. You have a high probability of actually letting your losers do more damage to your portfolio than they should if you are able to just say, it didn't work, I'm moving on and going to the next stage. And that's probably for most investors, anchoring and loss aversion, those are some of the bigger biases that they really should be trying to overcome.
There is also a real susceptibility we have as investors in following the news cycle and the trend of the day. So I've been around for a long time. I've covered the dot-com boom and bust, Bitcoin, investment trusts or income trusts, all those different things. How do you ensure that you aren't following where those bulls are running?
Well, as far as like a herd mentality,
yeah,
where everybody's jumping on the same bandwagon, and there's no question, you know, the herd mentality makes us feel safer because there's strength.
We're
numbers.
All going over that cliff. It's going to be great.
We all love Nortel. It's
yeah,
fine. It'll be okay. Everybody can't be wrong. Well, in retrospect. But, you know, the herd mentality, and you're right, because that can draw people all crowded into one investment strategy, one investment approach, and that can cause very detrimental aspects, especially if they're primarily focused on that. And getting outside of the herd is very difficult. And trying to be contrarian is difficult. And it's more of a lonely. I mean, the word contrarian, you're going to be lonely because mm-hmm, you're going to have views that differ from other people. But by and large, that's where most of the returns are made. This behavioral finance and behavioral economics, you know, it's a rising research discipline and it's getting more and more into the mainstream. But it's not new. I mean, Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett, they were all out there saying, you know, buy when the market is fearful and sell when the market is greedy. That is emotions. It's just, it's been such a long time that people started to actually look primarily or predominantly at the emotions and the other side of the trade. And is that person making a mistake to try and make money?
One of the other dynamics that industry folks have to deal with is the fact that they're measured. And so in the talk about Nortel, I know that was ages ago, but it drove the Canadian index to a point at which if you didn't hold Nortel, there was no way you were going to be able to deliver those returns. How do you as a money manager work to deliver returns knowing that you may not be holding the stock du jour, the one everybody's talking about?
Yeah, and today's example, of course, would be the FANG stocks in the U.S.
Yep.
If you don't own those five or six names in the U.S. market, you're down this year. If you own just them, you're up considerably. And the market in the U.S. is up sort of 4 or 5% at this point. So it's like it's being driven by a handful of names. So obviously, that has concerns for a portfolio manager. Now, if you can rise above that and not actually measure yourself to a benchmark every 6 months, every 12 months, then you can easily defeat it just acknowledge what the market's doing. I think today, I don't have a U.S. pure strategy, but if I were looking at a pure U.S. money manager that was beating the market today over the last number of years, I would be extremely fearful of them because that means they're taking such big bets on some of these very high momentum names that have been really dominating for the past 7-8 years that the risk in that portfolio is probably immense.
If you were to give one piece of advice for an average retail investor to try and manage the negative effect of the biases that they hold, what would it be?
I would do everything you can do to try and avoid performance chasing, which is part of the herd mentality. As far as if it's been doing well, doesn't mean it's going to keep doing well. You need to understand why things work in some markets, why they don't work in others, and really build your portfolios with that premise in mind.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Bassinger, Chief Investment Officer at Richardson GMP, on the biases that can sometimes how we invest. Coming up next on Moolala, how to save money on your commute. Personal finance expert Jessica Moorhouse will be here. And later, how to build wealth as an entrepreneur. Jeff Weiner on his new book, The Kick-Ass Entrepreneur's Guide to Investing. You can find me on Twitter at Bruce Selry, Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
For a lot of people, the commute to work isn't something that can be avoided. It just is what it is. With the price of gas and transit on the rise, commuting can be a major drain on your wallet. Here with some tips on how to cut commuting costs is personal finance expert Jessica Moorhouse. Hello there.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Do we have any idea how big an expense this is for the average family? I mean, it depends if you're driving 3 hours a day or...
Yeah. Numbers-wise, I couldn't tell you. I feel really bad talking about this topic, too, because I'm like, wow, my commute is almost non-existent now that I'm self-employed. However, it used to be a big expense when I worked downtown and had to commute every single day. Yeah,
so let's say for those who are really in it to win it, it's a big expense. And for some it is with gas and parking and all that kind of stuff. What are some ways in which people can cut down the cost?
I think basically it really is a matter of you're going to spend more money if you want to save on time. So that means if you want to drive to work more convenient and have a parking spot in your, you know, office's building, that's going to cost you money. The ways that that's going to cost you more money, but it's going to probably save you a little bit more time, be more convenient. If you want to save money, you got to do things that are a little bit more inconvenient, like take public transit, drive to the train station, then take the train to the office, carpool.
Let's talk about carpooling.
Why doesn't anyone like to carpool?
I think I would like, in some ways, I'd like the high occupancy lane that's on some roads. Yeah. I don't know if I'd want to talk to these people, though, because I think I would want to be like, have
my quiet
time.
But you like to talk
to
people.
I do, but on my own terms.
Not strangers?
I don't talk to people on planes anymore.
Oh, really?
Not even at all. I put earplugs in immediately.
Oh.
Makes me look rude, I guess.
So
we're looking at this through the lens of personal finance. How does carpooling save you money?
Well, then you could just split the cost of the, you know, gas, car, whatever. And I guess there's a couple different versions of carpooling because there is carpooling with strangers. I was kind of more thinking, find some people in your office who maybe live in your area and you can carpool together. I worked in an office and I knew lots of people lived in, you know, Burlington or wherever. And I'm like, why are you going separately in your separate cars? You could just pick each other up, split the cost of gas.
Did they answer your question? Did they say, here's why?
Not really. They kind of just like, oh, yeah, that's a nice idea. I'll think about
it.
And I get it. Like,
price of convenience.
Yeah, it's less convenient. It's not fun. Most people don't want to talk to people in the morning. But it's at the end of the day, it's like if you want to save money, you're going to have to do things that are uncomfortable and not fun. Like, that's just how it is.
Gas.
Yeah.
Do you shop around for gas? Should people shop around for gas?
I think so. And there's lots of great apps out there that
I
do
would
that.
Not drive 5 seconds out of my way to get a lower price of gas.
You wouldn't.
I know, which makes me...
But are you not really concerned about saving money?
I'm actually not.
So there you go.
I'm not.
Like, if you are, you will go that extra mile. Well, just like the same thing as if you want to save money on groceries, you will go that extra mile.
Oh, I'm nuts about saving money on groceries.
Go,
nuts.
Know,
I love me a flyer.
But you'll do the flyer, you'll go to a cheaper grocery store, you'll do what you got to do. So you'll do the same thing if you want to save money on gas. But if you don't, then you won't. But there's a couple different things. I mean, again, there's lots of apps that be like, oh, this place, you know, they monitor that kind of stuff for you, so don't really...
Have you tried any of these out?
Well,
the gas
number
apps?
One, I don't drive. My husband does, though.
Okay.
And so he definitely does. He does a couple different things. He definitely uses apps to see what different gas stations around, what has cheaper gas rates and everything like that. Also, parking is another big expense for him. And so there's another app, too, that tells you the cheapest lots and the rates and everything.
Do you know
like
the name of it?
No.
It's a
you
great thing.
You would think
we'll
I would have that prepared.
You
but no.
should. You got to write a specific thing on that.
I know.
Okay, Gas Buddy.
Yeah.
Is the Gas Buddy the gas station one?
Yes.
Oh, Parkopedia.
Yeah,
maybe
that's the
Parkopedia.
One. That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah.
Right.
So those are great ones.
How about loyalty programs? How do loyalty programs help?
Yeah. Like, I don't know why people are against loyalty programs. Whenever I see that in the news, I'm like, what do you have? What's wrong with they're free in general to join. You get free points or cash back or whatever. The only issue, I guess, if you do have a problem with spending is obviously the whole point of that, you know, loyalty program is to make you loyal to that brand or company. And they kind of incentivize you to spend a little bit more because you'll get more points or cash back or whatever if you spend more. So you just have to be cognizant of that.
Do you recommend people do the math on the price of their time? Because the reason I don't shop around for gas is it simply is not worth my time. I don't drive a lot. I take transit most of the time. So I don't fill up very regularly.
Right.
So the time it would take for me to put an app on my phone and then drive 5 seconds out of my
way. You sound like a millennial right now.
I do, really.
I'm like, it's not, just think of it. It's like, it's really not that hard to get an app on your phone and it does the work for you. That's what an app's for. It really doesn't take that much time. And if you really look at like, how are you actually spending your time? Are you spending 3 hours on Netflix? Then you have time to go use this app and just see if you can save like $10 on gas. Come on.
Wow. Okay. Other tips. What other tips? Yeah, I have been chastised on my own radio program. I have been chastised for poor financial behavior. I can't even believe it. Any other tips on cutting the cost of commuting?
Well, I think a lot of people do have the issue with driving versus taking public transit or just walking. Like I had a friend. She lived probably about the same distance from our office than I did. And I found out that she drove every day work and would park in the underground parking. And I'm like, how much are you spending? And hundreds of dollars every month. I'm like, and that's not including her car payments and gas and all that stuff. And so I'm like, that doesn't make sense. I know how much you make. This is really ridiculous expense, especially since you can just take the bus or whatever it is. And then she actually figured, actually, instead of taking the bus, I could probably just walk. Or she was pretty fit, so sometimes she ran to work. That was a bit much for me, but I'm like, good for you.
Good for you.
Killing, you know, two birds, one stone kind of that. But I think a lot of people just don't like the idea of public transit. And yeah, it's not fun, but again, it can save you so much money that you could do fun things with when you have that extra money.
I take public transit all the time. I even take the Greyhound bus.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, I've done that too.
Which is a whole other experience. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's an interesting. I took the Greyhound bus from Toronto to Cincinnati. That was an experience.
Why did you take the bus from Toronto to Cincinnati?
It was a special kind of experience. I was doing this event that was kind of a like an amazing race situation. So I had to get myself there real quick for really cheap. And it was interesting.
Wow, slightly safer than hitchhiking.
Yeah. It was just like, I kind of wish I had some pepper spray in my bag, but I survived. I spent like $50. It was great.
Wow. Given your focus on personal finance, how do you manage your opinions around other people?
Well,
or are you just like that person who just, another thing.
Oh,
here's
gosh,
what
no.
you should do.
Oh, gosh, no. And especially since I work with clients one-on-one as a financial counselor, I always want to make sure that no one feels like they're making there's a good, you know, way to do things and a bad thing. There's different options. I have my own personal opinions, things that have worked for me, but I also understand talking to so many people, there's different ways to do the same thing or different ways to do something to get the same result.
When you're looking at the cash flow of your clients, how do you determine whether commuting is even a variable that they should work on?
First, I usually look at, well, there's a couple different things. So we look at all their fixed expenses and variable expenses. We see what kind of problem area is. If, you know, they're making really good money and they're spending just a ton of money on more, you know, eating out or groceries or entertainment or whatever, that would be the focus. And really, if they're spending maybe a couple $100 on commuting, but again, their income is pretty good, then they're like, well, that's probably not that big of an issue. But if they're, you know, not earning that much and they're actually, you know, not spending that much on all the other elements, but that's the one thing that sticks out, it's like, well, that's the thing that we need to really focus on and see how we can kind of cut costs on there.
Cutting the cost. Jessica Morehouse, personal finance expert. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Coming up later, we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire with CEO of Coinsquare. His name is Cole Diamond. But next, entrepreneurs have different investing goals, different needs that can't always be met by financial advisors. Author Jeff Weiner is here to talk about how entrepreneurs can build wealth from their business's profits. Now, if you've got a question about money, I might have already answered it for you. You never know. It's not that I'm prescient. It's just that I've been writing about this stuff for a very long time. I'm a columnist for Money Sense. You can find many of the articles that I've written over the years at moneysense.ca. Search for me or just search the topic and see if I wrote about it. This could have been one of my esteemed colleagues instead. Stay with us. There's more Moolala after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You could probably argue that entrepreneurs are different from people with jobs in how they work, their tolerance for risk, and how they invest. Joining us now from Toronto is Jeff Weiner. He is an entrepreneur himself and the author of the Kick-Ass Entrepreneur's Guide to Investing. Hello there, Jeff.
Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
You retired as an entrepreneur at age 49. What would you say is different about your people, your tribe, than people with jobs?
Great question. So one of the things that's unique about entrepreneurs is that we need to save cash and be ready to take advantage of opportunities as they arise. So, for example, and I would say if business conditions change, there's a recession or whatnot, and there's a competitor for sale, one thing that an entrepreneur needs to have access to is cash, and it's really important. So competitor's up, let's say it's 2008, markets turned down, and you want to buy your competitor, that's when you have need to have access to cash. And most entrepreneurs don't hang on to cash. They invest their assets probably incorrectly, too heavily invested into the equity markets. And I can get into that in a little further if you want.
I can imagine that's a disconnect for an entrepreneur working with a financial advisor who doesn't have experience with that mindset, because most financial advisors, depending on how they're comped, but most of them are comped based on assets under management. They would want them to be in the very traditional equity market.
That's true. So that was my finding as well, is that most financial advisors don't understand how the entrepreneur needs to invest. So they make the mistake of looking at the entrepreneur's total amount available. They look at their age, their propensity for risk. Then they design a portfolio without really taking into consideration that the entrepreneur already has potentially a large stake in equity, which is really their business. So the advisor will do, let's say, a 60-40 asset split and say 60% equities, 40% bonds, for example, and 60% of the entrepreneur's available cash is now in the equity market. So if I can give you an example, let's say that an entrepreneur, let's say their business is worth, pick an easy number, $1 million. And then let's say they have $500,000 cash available to invest. So if they go to the advisor and they say to the advisor, look, I've got $500,000 to invest, and the advisor does a 60-40 equity bond split, the entrepreneur is now left with a very high weighting in equities. And in the example that I just gave you, they've got somewhere in the order of 90% of their total allocation invested in equities, their business plus the amount that the financial advisor has put into the stock market. And now market turns, they have no dollars available to take advantage of opportunities as they arise.
You write about something called the three bucket strategy. Tell us about that.
So it's an age-old asset allocation strategy. It's actually 2,000 years old. It comes from the Talmud, and it suggests that you break your assets in two thirds. And so the actual quote itself is, let every man divide his money, I guess it could be in this 2018 age, mm-hmm. his or her money into three parts, invest a third in land, a third in business, and a third let him keep in reserve. So if we break that down, the third is in real estate. So the real estate component is investment real estate. We're not looking at your home. That is, so if you have $1 million home, that's not included as part of your overall asset allocation. A third would be in equities. And in my case, I'm suggesting that it's the business is part of the equity portfolio. And a third would be in cash. And then again, in my case, I've invested in bonds. And that proclamation is actually 2,000 years old. And that's exactly what I did. So I was looking for, when I was running my business for many years, I spoke to many financial advisors. I had trouble figuring out how to invest, and I used this asset allocation strategy. And that third equity bucket, I bought multi-unit residential apartment buildings both in Canada and the U.S. Now, that strategy has been time-tested over or back-tested over many years and compared to several other much more complicated investing strategies, and it's actually produced similar returns as what you would get from much more complicated hedge fund or other types of strategies.
Let's talk about the equity portion for a second, because if you leave and focus your equity portion on the business that you run, on the one hand, that's focused, that's loyalty, that's belief in your business, but it is not diversified.
It is not diversified, absolutely. So you're right, and that's a major risk that an entrepreneur is taking. But by investing further into the equity markets, they're putting themselves even they're making themselves even further exposed.
But why wouldn't you take that third, put half in the business and a half in a boring old exchange traded fund?
So that's part of the allocation strategy. I'm saying a third is now invested in real estate, and real estate has produced huge. Now, I'm not talking about the typical homeowner who buys their home for $300,000 and 15 years later, it's worth $1 million. I'm talking about using real estate as an investment vehicle. So if you have $300,000 to invest, I'm suggesting you buy a triplex or a quad, or if you have even more, buy a small multi-unit residential building. There are things that you can do in investment real estate by playing, I'm going to call it understanding the way that cap rates work in multi-unit residential and commercial real estate, and taking advantage of how you can increase your wealth by improving rents, lowering costs and expenses in the building, et cetera. So I'm saying allocate a third of your wealth toward real estate and a third allocate toward cash, and that's so you can take advantage of the opportunities as they arise, and it keeps you fairly liquid. I'm not suggesting that people don't buy stocks and equities. I think, look, so if you're a typical investor without a business, you need to take some of those risks. Yes, go buy equities. But for a typical business owner, stay out of the equity. Well, for the most part, stay out of the equities markets.
With the pitfall that if your business does not thrive, you're not diversified.
Well, if your business does not thrive and you've been following my third asset allocation strategy, you've now potentially got multi-unit residential real estate that's producing an annuity income for you and that's been appreciating in value. And you've got your cash that's been sitting aside. And now you've got two-thirds of your wealth that's still now nicely secured into other buckets. Your business has gone out of business, but you're not left with nothing. Mm. Now, on the other hand, if you do have $1 million, let's say, for example, a business, and then you have $500,000, and 2008 happens all over again, and the markets go down by 50%, you're left very exposed. Not only is your business exposed, but so is the equity that's sitting in the stock market now very exposed as well. And by the way, you want to take advantage of opportunities, and you don't have the cash to do it.
It's a very high level of cash for most people. Do you think that that split applies to people who aren't entrepreneurs?
So when I say the word cash, so the Talmud strategy actually says keep it in reserve. My recommendation, and I'm not the only person that's talking about this, and this has been written about by multiple investment advisors, the cash component that they're referring to is actually bonds. So it is producing an annuity of a small sort, and it typically works to great extent countercyclical to the market itself. As bonds going up, equity markets are going down. But, you know, as interest rates are going up, then typically the equity markets are going down and vice versa. So you are diversifying your risks to some extent.
One of the things that I've noticed in years working with entrepreneurs, covering entrepreneurs, is how amazing they are at building top line and focusing on top line ruthlessly, but sometimes sloppy on bottom line. It's just less of a deal for them. Not to say that their businesses aren't profitable, but for the money that they extract, that they don't ensure that they're getting return outside of the business. Is that a fair characterization?
I would say it's almost universal, and it's very frustrating. I'm working with a very successful entrepreneur now who called me, and he said, look, I want you to help me act as a consultant, help me build my revenues, take them from, and actually these are real numbers, I want to double my revenues from 3 to 6 million, and I want you to help me with marketing. So we went in to start talking about marketing in general, and what we uncovered was that the business wasn't profitable. He needed to fix some of the cash flow issues. This is consistent over and over. I had dinner with someone last night, same thing. He's like so focused on building top revenue, top line, and they completely miss the whole concept of how to build bottom line. See, entrepreneurs, by their very nature, are typically they're typically sales-oriented or marketing-oriented. They're not necessarily accounting-oriented, don't understand gross margin, and don't understand how to properly save profits or revenue, let's say, and move that into a profit bucket. And I actually have another book that I haven't written yet that talks about how do you allocate your profits, or how do you create more profits from your business. And one of the things I talk about, I was listening to your show the other day, and you talk about it, I wouldn't say often, but you suggest take 10% of your salary and move it in and put it into, you know, pay yourself first, invest that. And I tell entrepreneurs the same thing. If you want to earn 10% EBITDA, so 10% of your revenue as profit, so if you're doing $1 million a year revenue, $100,000 a year profit, take So $100,000 a year, take $8,000 a month and stick it up into a holding company or put it into right away, right off the top. Look at it like a tax and take that $8,000 and put it away. It's not even available to play with. And that will definitely, hey, there's a forced way of saving just as you would as an individual as you can do as an entrepreneur as well.
Interesting. Jeff, we'll have to leave it there. Appreciate your time and good luck getting book two written. You know, book writing's too hard. I can't believe you're writing a second already. Jeez.
It's so funny because I was listening to your podcast the other day and you said the same thing to another author.
Oh, God.
So
it's my one piece of advice. Don't write a book. It's too hard.
It's a passion.
Well, that's something too. Jeff Weiner, the author of The Kick-Ass Entrepreneur's Guide to Investing. Coming up next, want to follow Jeff's profit strategy, but you're not an entrepreneur yet? We'll find out how to financially prepare if you want to start your own business. And we'll take CoinSquare's Cole Diamond through the Moolala questionnaire. If you're looking for some books to help you with personal finances, there's so many great ones out there. Wealthy Barber, Wealthy Barber Returns, Worry-Free Money. I've even written a couple of them. You can find all of these online. My latest is the Moolala Guide to Rocking Your RRSP. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We know. We should be saving a little bit every month, but sometimes that's easier said than done. It's not uncommon for people to live paycheck to paycheck, especially those people who are freelancers or self-employed. However, if you want to succeed as an entrepreneur, you're going to have to break the cycle and stick to some serious budgeting and saving. Here to tell us more is personal finance expert and accredited financial counselor Canada, Jessica Morehouse. Hello there.
Oh, hi.
Accredited financial counselor Canada. What does that mean?
Well, within Canada, I'm an accredited financial counselor. But what that really means is I help clients one-on-one throughout Canada. We meet online and I help them with whatever their financial situation is.
How do you earn that designation?
School. So basically, if you Google like AFCC or Accredited Financial Counselor Canada, the website will come up, the organization, and it's you get some books, you take a couple exams, and you get, I think, about 3 years experience, and then you've got your accreditation.
All right. Well, one of the things you, I'm sure, work with people on is cash flow. And, and do you work with people on becoming entrepreneurs?
Oh, yeah. Lots of the people I work with are self-employed or freelancers or side hustlers. So they got a full-time
side hustlers.
Job.
So if someone's thinking of leaving their job to work for themselves, what are the kinds of things that they should do to prepare?
Oh, gosh. And this is really, you know, this is exactly what I did
this
almost
is
2 years ago.
This is my
me.
Life.
So when I have someone that comes to me, I'm like, okay, there's a few things that I wish I'd known. So I'm going to help you out. Really having a good pile of cash, that emergency fund needs to be like, for me, I think I saved about 9 months of my living expenses. Because even if you've started like that business on the side, so you are earning some revenue, you may not necessarily know how much you can earn if you dedicate your resources to doing that job full time. And that was for me. So I made sure I had a ton of cash in case I didn't earn anything. I had, you know, everything sorted so I can pay all my bills. So that's kind of number one. Number two is definitely make sure that your cost of running your business is very low. I think a lot of people get excited, and so they're like, I need this software, I need to get an office space, I need to do this and that. Keeping your costs low will mean more money in your pocket. And then as you gradually grow your business, get more clients, get more sales, whatever your business is, then you can start spending more money.
What about on the expense front personally? Did you institute an austerity plan yourself when you made that change?
Oh, definitely. I was on the strictest of budgets.
Ramen noodles and Value Village.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I just didn't shop, like full stop.
Not even
like,
Value Village. Not even for a Halloween costume. No.
And I just didn't go out. I just stayed inside.
That sounds fun.
Yeah.
It's a big commercial for becoming an entrepreneur.
I knew it was temporary. And that's kind of the thing. You need to remember in your first year of kind of, you know, being a solopreneur or whatever you want to call yourself, it's going to be a very lean year, but the goal is that, well, number one, you're probably doing something that makes you happier than maybe your previous job, and it won't always be like that. Hopefully you're good at what you do and your business will continue to grow. You'll make more money, and that's my experience, and that's usually what people tend to do if they follow my advice.
There is an enormous lethargy for people in changing financial institutions. Do you think it's important for entrepreneurs to do some due diligence on who they bank with before they make that leap?
100%. Not even just entrepreneurs, anybody. So when I'm working with a client, the first thing I usually ask them, like, are you paying bank fees? And then I ask them, why? Because there are so many great financial institutions now that are completely online, or credit unions that
I can answer the question to why. Because I've been with the same bank since I was 10.
Why?
Because it's the bank I was with when I was 10. But I will say, so I say that half tongue in cheek. Do bank fees really matter?
Yeah.
Why?
Do you pay $100 a year just for holding a bank? They're making money off your money anyway.
But I would spend $100 a year on dinner. So the switching cost.
You could have an extra $100 for more dinner if you didn't pay fees.
Ooh, that sounds good. But I guess what I think is important is the having people deal with the switching costs. Mm-hmm. So is it worth $100 to switch institutions?
Yeah, well, in general, it doesn't cost you any money to switch financial institutions.
Time.
Like, yeah, time.
Energy.
Yeah, everyone has time. Everyone has so much more time than they think. Come on.
Have you watched The Crown already?
Like twice.
Twice already. Okay,
and
so
I had enough time to switch banks.
Wow. What do you do when you reach a certain point and there's nothing left to cut back on?
That's when you're going to need to start making more money. So even if you're an entrepreneur and you're starting out and you're really trying to make it work and you've cut everything you can, that's when it's time to just do something extra on the side, get a part-time job, or see if there's some sort of gigs on Kijiji or Craigslist and do what you got to do. Like, that is my motto. It's like, you got to do what you got to do to make that money. So just make that money.
What was your first job?
Oh, my first ever job was like working at The Gap during Christmas season, selling
really?
Khakis.
Were you any good at it?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you're so personable. I thought you would have been great.
I was so nervous when I was like 15.
Oh,
no. I was the worst. And I'm pretty sure I didn't necessarily get fired and I didn't really quit. I just stopped showing
up. It was Christmas. the hours were cut back in January anyway.
I assumed my job was done when Christmas was over.
Of course,
but I am
you
not
didn't
sure.
show up. You're like, was I still on the schedule?
I'm not sure if I'm still employed.
What was the worst job you ever had?
Oh, that's a good question.
Mine was cleaning the pennies out of the fountain at a small little amusement park in London, Ontario called Storybook Gardens.
It's a very specific job.
It was a very specific job. It was only part of my job. I also took 2 months to paint a fence and sprayed the goose poo off the sidewalks.
Yeah, that's I've never done any dirty jobs. I've been pretty lucky in
really?
That. I've had lots of jobs that have been – I mean, I've actually had I have a really bad rap for – going with like starting with an employer and that employer going bankrupt.
Wow.
So I've had some bad jobs in that respect where they just end. Like,
were you
collapse.
Kind of, did you have to go like get smudged or do a cleanse before you started your own business so that same fate would not befall you?
I never thought of that, but probably
maybe that's an
Knock
idea.
On wood, everything's fine.
Jeez.
But yeah, it was like one after the other.
How did you build the business case for you launching your own business? And therefore, what advice would you have for other people? Because you talked about cutting expenses and emergency fund and all that stuff. But it would seem like you need to do some budgeting in order to have that to pull that off.
Absolutely. Like for me, when people say, oh, how did you do it? I'm like, it took me 7 years. It took me 7 years to get to where I am today. And for me, 5 of those years was doing this business while I was working full time. So I can play around with things and see how I could actually structure this business if I did go out on my own. And in terms of budgeting, because I know we talked a little bit about, you know, budgeting for your business, but also for your personal finances. And this is something that, you know, I deal with, but also my husband's been self-employed for 11 years and he's always struggled with, you know, I have a variable income. There's just a couple different things that you can try out. And there's not necessarily one right way or wrong way. One thing that I do is, again, I always have a big kind of funnel account, I call it. It has a bunch of cash in there. So money flows in and flows out, but there's never going to be a point where I won't have enough to pay my bills or if you know, I'm waiting for invoices.
What is the number one thing you would do differently if you were starting your business today, if you had a do-over?
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell me you wouldn't do it because I'm assuming you would.
Know,
would you
like,
would you do it? Would you start your own business? Or would you go back to the corporate world?
Oh, I work so hard so I never have to go back to the corporate world.
Right.
And that's why I'm like, when I talk to clients, they're like, oh, I just don't have enough money. I'm like, I would get a job in a shop tomorrow if it meant prevent it. Like, because that for me isn't corporate. It's like, I just cannot go back to an office. So I'll do what I need to do to make money.
Right.
So there's, you know, there's endless possibilities. I will become an Uber driver if that means
good idea.
Staying, you know, self-employed.
So coming back to this do-over thing, is there anything that you would do differently if you had a chance to do it all over again?
I mean, honestly, looking back, there's a couple things, but no, I think I kind of did it the best way I could have done it. I don't really have any major regrets of how I did it. I probably wish I had a little bit more time to prepare. For me, I basically decided to quit my job and left within 2 months. So I did give them actually quite a good amount of time to prepare everything. But I wish I had like a good 6 month for sure. I'm preparing 6 months in advance.
Did you take some pens and post-it notes home with you? Did you take your stapler?
Yeah, I took as much as I could. Screw those people. No, I'm just kidding.
Jessica, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica Morehouse. She is an accredited Financial Counselor Canada, a whole new acronym for me, and personal finance expert. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. Our guest is Cole Diamond. He's the CEO of Toronto-based digital currency exchange Coinsquare. And Cole, here's the question. How would you describe your money personality?
My money personality?
Yeah.
Incredibly aggressive.
Were you always incredibly aggressive?
Yes.
Where do you think that comes from?
I've got a good sense of money. I'm fairly comfortable playing around between X and Y, making sure that, I never fall below a certain threshold and trying to get as aggressive as I can about making sure that Y is considerably bigger than X.
What was your first job growing up? You probably weren't, you weren't babysitting, were you? You were holding like raves or something.
Funny enough, my first job was as a promoter promoting concerts for a band that some friends of mine were in.
My intuition was right. Who was your money mentor growing up?
Probably my dad.
How so?
So he was a business consultant. He consulted to a number of technology entrepreneurs, and I did his invoices. And so that gave me a good sense of how these businesses worked. And I had a lot of questions, and he answered my questions. And that gave me the good sense of money and capital that I have today.
What's one thing you still worry about when it comes to money, if anything?
Central banks. And funny enough, found my way into the decentralized world of cryptocurrency. Inevitably, Bitcoin's got a maximum number of 21 million Bitcoins that will ever be released. And the U.S. Federal Reserve and Canada's central bank can print as much money as they want. And it scares me as to where that can go and where all these debts are going to end. And that's what's given me comfort around cryptocurrency.
What is one financial behavior of your own that you would say you're still working on? Or are you perfect? Are you the only person who has ever answered this questionnaire who is perfect?
No, not even close. I make huge money mistakes all the time. And you know what? I think my biggest money mistake is that I trust too much and too quickly, which means that I end up putting a lot of money into other people's ideas when I should be putting more money into my own, because I've proven to be a lot more successful betting on myself than other people.
What's your worst financial mistake?
Oh, God. There's a long list of
And I'm asking for your worst. That's hard.
I'd actually rather answer the question a little bit more generally, but I don't sell on the way up often enough.
Okay. What's one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Hotels, by far.
The best hotel you've ever stayed at in the world is?
The Aman Hotel, 2.5-hour drive, very bumpy and curvy drive outside of Athens in Greece. It is the most incredible place anyone could ever stay.
Why?
Forewarning, it's $2,400 Canadian dollars a night.
Ah, well, I'm sure I can get it on Hotwire for a fraction of that. I'm sure that's how that's how they roll. What is one thing that has that hotel stand out in your mind?
Service was impeccable. The place was basically a refactored version of the Acropolis. And it was incredibly exclusive with delicious food. There wasn't one thing about it. It was flawless.
Wow. What does financial freedom mean to you?
It means being able to make the decisions that I want to make every day when I wake up in the morning as to what I want to put my time towards. And hopefully that's philanthropy.
With philanthropy, what is a cause that you are particularly passionate about?
My grandfather brought a charity to Canada called Save a Child's Heart. It's focused on providing life-saving heart surgery to children in Israel. 50% of them come from the Palestinian territories, and the other 50% come from developed nations around the world. They come to Israel, they get free life-saving heart surgery. I view it personally, even though some people disagree with me, as a grassroots peace initiative. Mm. Save one life at a time. But I also, my grandfather was my best friend before we lost him. And anything to carry his name forward is an absolute honor.
Wow. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
I think it would be to try and get greed out of those that are in the fee-based business. And it sounds funny because I'm in the fee-based business. But I think what we're trying to do at CoinSquare is disrupt it quite a bit, because there's just too much money being made by a very, very small group of people that in theory help facilitate transactions, when in theory there's something else going on, which is too much regulation around that exists to protect this small group of people from that income coming in. So I think inevitably we need to find a way to remove the greed, and we need to find a way to distribute more value to all of our citizens.
Cole, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Bruce. Pleasure.
Cole Diamond with the Moolala Questionnaire. He is the CEO of Toronto-based digital currency exchange CoinSquare. That is our program for today. If you want to join in on the conversation, please drop us a line to ask@moolala.ca. You can also tweet us at Bruce Selry or make a comment at Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Our website, moolala.ca, is where you can find lots more content. You can also download the full podcast at iTunes or any of the other podcast platforms out there and subscribe to the next episode, so it's just going to arrive on your device. Thanks very much for joining us today. We appreciate it. Have a great day.